First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's been a welcomed trigger to dig deeper into a topic that has been of a great interest for me, to me for a very long time. And as you might have been noticed already, I'll do my presentation in English, since it's my academic language. Og selv om jeg er en stolt sandjaværing, English has been my primary language for the last 15 years, so my Norwegian has unfortunately become quite rusty. I'll try to speak slowly and clearly, and I hope you can all bear with me. And I'm open to have questions afterwards if you are wondering about anything I have to say here. But yeah, simply put, the title of my presentation is A Reminder on Small States and Self-Determination. And the argument that I'm here to present today is this. The states of Central and East Europe have been under the yoke of Russian imperialism for centuries. Takk, Nille, kjære søster. They have every reason to be wary of Russia and to seek out international security guarantees to protect their newly won sovereignty and independence. And yes, that might include joining NATO. But I would like to start by saying quite clearly, this is not a lecture on comparative imperialism. I'm not here to diminish the imperialist track record of NATO. What I'm here to do is to present a perspective that is often overlooked in the debate on the war in Ukraine. And that perspective is of the recently re-established states of Central and East Europe. And their perspective is this. NATO, and with it the EU, with its many imperfections and faults, represents to them democracy, human rights, and economic prosperity. But more importantly, these institutions offer them the most dependable security guarantee from the historic and contemporary antagonist, namely Russian imperialism. And contemporary is a key word here. For while Russia has a very long and rich imperial history, it is also still very much alive. And it's impossible to understand the history of this region, let alone the present day situation, without understanding the history of Russian imperialism. I will concentrate mainly on the more immediate past, so from the 1980s and up until today, but we'll also go into the deeper history of it. I'll try not to make it into a long history lecture, but we still have to focus on history, because it's history that has brought us to this point we are in today. Or more precisely, it's a lack of historical understanding and an emphasis and misuse of myths instead. This ahistoricism and mythological approach is well reflected in Putin's speeches, which does away with Ukraine's independent historic past. This is also sadly reflected in some of the narratives we see here at home in Norway. These narratives often overlook the historic and lived experiences of Central and East Europe. It removes the agency of the people of this region, along with their sovereign and independent capacity to act upon these experiences. So, what is these experiences of Russian imperialism? Well, it can come in many forms, depending on the time and place, and the capacity of Russia itself. I have, for convenience sake, split it up in three main elements, that is, cultural, military, and political economic. I've also chosen Lithuania and Ukraine as my main protagonists in this story, as their experience is a good example of the shared experience of this region. I'll also draw on examples from other states when needed, but these will be the two main states we'll follow through this. So, starting with the cultural element of Russian imperialism. This has mainly been characterized by the forced Russification of imperial subjects, and luckily has largely been relegated to a historic past, at least up until now. It has somewhat changed, but we'll go into that a little bit later. Russification can come in many forms, from suppression of language and religion to mass deportation and genocide. In Lithuania, during the Russian Empire, the use of Lithuanian language was banned, along with a heavy suppression of the local Catholic Church. Unsurprisingly, these policies were actively opposed by the people of Lithuania. The book smugglers, a series of loose-knit underground groups, composed of everyone between bishops and housewives. They smuggled in prohibited Lithuanian language books at the risk of imprisonment, exile, or even death. Through this, they kept both language and religion, and with it, Lithuanian identity and culture alive. In Ukraine, an arguably even harsher process took place. Not only was the local Ukrainian church heavily suppressed, but the very idea that the Ukrainian language existed as a separate language, and that Ukrainian identity existed as a separate identity, was actively purged from both history and the public sphere. To quote the Russian interior minister from 1863, "There was not, is not, and cannot be any special Little Russian language," Little Russian being an imperialist term for Ukraine. These processes of Russification had a brief pause after the revolutionary years of 1905 and 1917, but were vigorously reapplied by Stalin and took on a much darker tone. At least 280,000 Lithuanians, which is a huge number for a very small state, was deported by the Soviets to the Far East. And up to 5 million Ukrainians died in the man-made famines of the 1930s. While the cultural element of Russian imperialism became less relevant by the 1990s, it never fully disappeared. And with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it has come back to the forefront again. The Russian regime's aforementioned denial of Ukrainian statehood and nationhood, the purging of the Ukrainian language from occupied territories, along with the looting of museums and the destruction of cultural monuments, all hint at the renewed Russification of Ukraine. Whether these policies qualify as genocide, as some argue they do, is still up for debate. As for the militant element of Russian imperialism, it has, of course, included the violent incorporation of people into the empire, as seen by the conquest of Siberia, the Far East, and Central Asia. But it also includes the repression of imperial subjects and the crushing of resistance against occupation. Both Lithuania and Ukraine actively resisted their incorporation into the Russian Empire. The Lithuanians, for example, joined their Polish compatriots into a series of rebellions against the Russian Empire, both in 1794, 1830, and 1864, just to mention a few. These were met by heavy, heavy oppression, including massacres, executions, and deportations. The incorporation of Ukraine into the Russian Empire was also highly contested, and not a straightforward reunification of ancient Rus lands, as some Russian historians might make you believe. The agreement, which established the relationship between the Russian Empire on one side and the independent Ukrainian Cossack Hetmanate in 1654, was a treaty of protection against the Poles specifically, and not a treaty of submission to the Tsar. And it was also consistently violated by the Russian Empire, which of course led to plenty of rebellions. This resistance to Russian imperialism continued well into the 20th century. As the Soviet Union reoccupied the Baltics in the 1940s, resistant groups were formed, collectively known as the Forest Brothers. The Forest Brothers, fighting both the Soviet and subsequent German occupation, reached an estimated strength of 30,000 fighters among thousands of women in Lithuania alone, and they were supported by an even larger network of civilian sympathizers. While the Forest Brothers were largely suppressed by the late 1950s, the last Lithuanian Forest Brother died in combat in 1965, and in Estonia, the last Forest Brother was killed in combat in 1974. As for Ukraine, its reincorporation into the empire, following the revolutions of 1905 and 1917, was even more contested than its first incorporation. Left-leaning intellectuals, autocratic nationalists, and anarchist peasants all fought against the Soviet Union. And it was also due to this diversity, unfortunately, that disagreement and infighting was very common among these groups. But it is still at this time we see the first formation of modern Ukrainian statehood. And it was not a gift from Lenin, as Putin might say. It was fought for, declared by, and defended by Ukrainians. When the Ukrainian Soviet Republic was set up by the Soviet Union, they were recognizing an already established fact on the ground and not creating something out of thin air. This legacy of oppression and resistance was very familiar to the nationalities of the Soviet Union as the Soviet Union started teetering on the edge in the 1980s. And it was the very issue of nationalities and specifically their will for independence that led to the empire's undoing. I think the massive and peaceful independence movements in the Baltics, collectively known as the Singing Revolutions, is the best example of this. They took to the streets in the Baltics in song and dance to demand their independence. And this was culminated in 1989 on the 50th anniversary of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, which had led to the Soviet annexation of the Baltic republics in the 1940s. And the visual climax of these singing revolutions was when 2 million people joined hands and formed a human chain stretching 700 kilometers from Vilnius in the south to Tallinn in the north. And they had one demand, and that was independence and end of Russian Soviet occupation. And in this, Lithuania led the charge. Lithuania declared unilaterally, re-established its independence on the 11th of March, 1990. It was the first Soviet republic to do so. But the response from Moscow was as immediate as it was brutal. Soviet troops were sent to Vilnius, in effect invading an independent state by this time, but were met with a sea of protests. And on the 13th of January 1991, in what would go down as Lithuania's Bloody Sunday, 14 of these peaceful protesters were killed by Soviet troops. 12 were shot, 2 were run over by tanks and crushed to death. Half a year later, and exactly to the day, exactly 6 months before the fall of the Soviet Union, Soviet special forces attacked a newly established Lithuanian border post. 7 Lithuanian border guards were summarily executed. They were forced down on the ground and shot in the back of their heads. In this, Lithuania was far from the only one to feel the wrath of the fallen colossus. As Cecilia already kind of mentioned, in Riga, in Latvia, 6 protesters were also killed by Soviet troops. Estonia only escaped a similar crackdown when the local commander and later president of independent Chechnya, Dudayev, refused his order to attack. He is still a big hero, interestingly enough, in Estonia for this. But crucially, the fall of the Soviet Union did not spell an end to military intervention. Quite the opposite. Unilateral military intervention became a hallmark of Russian foreign policy in post-Soviet space. For example, Russian weapons and volunteers, along with direct military intervention, was paramount to the separatist victory in Moldova in 1992. Georgia received a similar treatment in the civil war years of 91 to 93, when 2 different separatist movements was fighting to establish their own republics. Russia was again key to their victories. And while these conflicts might have been brought on by local dynamics, they were inflamed by Russia. And these 3 de facto states would not have existed if it was not for Russian intervention. And their continued existence is only guaranteed by Russian military, political, and economic support. And here I would like to make a point. Because while Russia often derides the illegal and unilateral military interventions of the US and NATO, epitomized by the NATO intervention in Kosovo, Russia was a forerunner in this regard. The Kosovo intervention was predated nearly by a decade by the Russian interventions. That is not to say that the Kosovo intervention is not to be critiqued, it is. But as for Russian military interventions, as it got away, the Russians also formulated a foreign policy concept to support their interventions. And this foreign policy concept still defines Russian foreign policy in the region to this day. It was coined in 1992 and is called the Near Abroad. And it constitutes all the former Soviet republics and was defined as a special Russian sphere of interest, where the Russian had a special privilege and could, through military, economic, and political means, intervene whenever they felt their interest threatened. And it can be seen as Russia's very own Monroe Doctrine, So like the Americans think Latin America is their backyard and their domain. The Russians see the post-Soviet republics as their domain. Or to put it in the words of an academic from 1994, you can take the republics away from Russia, but you cannot get Russia out of the republics. So this is, I would say, what forms the perspectives of many states in Central and East Europe to today. It's the memory of Tsarist and Soviet imperial occupation and repression. It's Soviet attacks on independence movements. It's the uninvited demarcation of a Russian special sphere of interest. And it's unilateral military interventions. It should also come as no surprise that so many then sought guarantees from NATO from the very beginning of their existence. I don't think their future would have looked much better if they hadn't done that. And I would like to make another point here that's quite important, I think. Because when we look at the background for NATO's expansion to the east, we have to have these perspectives and experiences of the Central European states at the center. Because NATO was enthusiastically and adamantly invited by the states of Central and East Europe. It should also be clear to everyone that NATO, even if NATO had acted less arrogantly in victory in the after the Cold War, and even if they had disbanded, it would not have changed the imperialist trajectory of Russia. From the very end of the Soviet Union to the first days of Russia reborn, the imperialist legacy lived on. The unilateral military interventions in Moldova and Georgia clearly show this. While Ukraine was not a victim of any military intervention during the 90s, it did feel the full brunt of the political and economic side of Russian imperialism. As soon as Ukraine voted for independence, Russian interference into Ukrainian domestic affairs began. While direct military intervention was off the table, threats were not. So when Ukraine's first president, Leonid Kravchuk, held a Western-centric position, he was quickly perceived as a threat by Yeltsin and the Kremlin. Disputes quickly flared up, and Russia consequently refused to recognize Ukrainian territorial integrity. It questioned Ukraine's sovereignty and started supporting separatist movements in Crimea. And in what would become a hallmark of Russian policy towards Ukraine, Russia employed its significant economic and political leverage to force Ukraine to follow its will. Economic sanctions became the weapon of choice of Russia here. Because of the legacy of the Soviet Union, Ukraine was dependent on Russian gas. So whenever Ukraine refused to toe the Russian line, economic sanctions would be imposed and gas prices would increase. With economic pressure, political interference was not far behind. When Kravchuk stood for re-election in 1994, Russia poured money onto the more Russian-friendly opposition candidate, Leonid Kuchma, and launched a large-scale media campaign in his favor. Boris Yeltsin got directly involved, and he urged Ukrainians to vote for Kuchma. Similarly, in 2004, during the presidential elections then, the Russians also got involved with large-scale financial and media support given to the Russian-friendly candidate, Viktor Yanukovych. Putin also traveled to Kiev and told Ukrainians to vote for Yanukovych. When he eventually lost to the more Western-oriented opposition candidate, Viktor Yushchenko, who also survived an alleged Russian assassination attempt in the running, Russian economic and political pressure was again put on Ukraine to coerce them back into line. Is this carrot and stick approach, which is the hallmark of Russian policy towards Ukraine? When Ukraine toes the line, it gets to taste the carrot in the form of financial and political support. But whenever they assert themselves independently, the whip comes out with economic sanctions and price hikes. And when that was not enough, brute force and military means was the next logical step. So the title of my talk is A Reminder. And that's because in the Norwegian debate about the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it shouldn't be necessary to point out the importance of taking into account the perspectives of small states and pointing to their legitimate defense of their right to self-determination in the face of imperialist onslaught. Norway is not a great power, but there's still a lot of academics in the Norwegian debate who ignore the Ukrainian perspective and Ukraine's interests. To quote, "The conflict is primarily not about Ukraine, but about the security architecture for Europe. The war is a proxy war between the United States and Russia." This circle of academics needs to be reminded of the history of Russian imperialism. They are anti-imperialists and on the side on the left. But their focus has been on the imperialism of the US and NATO. And there's plenty of good reasons for that. But there's no reason to be single-minded. In order not to undermine the very credibility of anti-imperialism, it is necessary to shed the light on Russian imperialism and its legacy and its historical roots, which has been left in the shadows for too long. And this is a reminder to all of us, because it's my impression that there has been and still is little knowledge of and little attention paid towards Russian imperialism and its legacy. And that is all too well reflected in the public debate here in Norway. Thank you very much. Thank you.